Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's broadcast of the Alchemy of Light show. I am Jamil Graham, your host, and I am so grateful to be welcoming all of you today. The Alchemy of Light broadcast is a celebration and exploration of consciousness, how we feel and think, because everything begins with a feeling. And this week's show is really significant to me on the level of consciousness, perhaps in a way that none of the shows before have met this mark, in that we are at a time in our human evolution as we are approaching the solstice and as we are witnessing in our world a radical transformation of consciousness. And our guest today is a person I have a tremendous respect for. I consider him a person of great value in his thought and opinion and research in the Mayan calendar. He is an intuitive scholar in that he has approached the calendar from a love of the people and a love of the culture. And since 1979, has weathered the storms and the incredible dialogue that has accompanied the Mayan calendar. And he has written three books in English that have been translated into many languages about the Mayan calendar: The Purposeful Universe, How Quantum Theory and Mayan Cosmology Explain the Origin and Evolution of Life, The Solving of the Greatest Mystery of Our Time, the Mayan Calendar, and the most recent work, The Mayan Calendar and the Transformation of Consciousness. And it's from this third book that this interview will focus. And so without further ado, I would like to please welcome Carl to the show. Hello, Carl.
Hello. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you here.
Thank you very much as well for joining us. I am really excited about bringing your presence and your intuitive thoughts and guidance to all of us in this conversation of our transformation of consciousness. And I would like to throw a pin in the wheel of this spinning dialogue of the end of this calendar intentionally to begin the conversation of the Mayan calendar as the beginning, and speaks in a very focused and loving way about the beginning of this ninth wave and how this ninth wave is reflecting itself in our culture, how it may evolve in our culture, and different things we might be able to do, see, and participate in as it becomes the dominant reality that we are all sharing. And one of the things I've heard you speak about quite a lot in ways that I have found very grounded and helpful is regarding the economy and the way our shift of exchange has been affected and will continue to be affected, and as well the word of our new beginning being unity and shifting from the lords and ladies of duality who have been a very dominant energy, been dominating actually the planet and our human consciousness, now moving into unity, which is perhaps more of the sovereign mind, the mind of personal responsibility, and how are we going to recreate our world. And so from here, I'd really like to offer you, Carl, an opportunity to introduce yourself in your words and to pick up the conversation what feels appropriate on that level.
Yeah. Well, thank you to begin with. I think you have really pointed out some of the most relevant aspects of my work just by talking about the ninth wave and how that is now changing the world, maybe not dramatically in the way that some would have thought, or maybe even what I would have thought, but it is just sort of will constantly, in the future, have a subtle effect, I think, on all of us humans. And that is what is going to transform our world. So I think the best thing is really to do a a short summary of of how to understand the Mayan calendar. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely.
Okay. So, those that have, some of you, the listeners, might have been to the Guatemala and to southern Mexico and visited those sites where the Maya culture prospered. There's an old, traditional, ancient culture of the Maya, but then there is also their present-day descendants that are still living in this area. So, you know, it's not always correct to, when people are talking about the Maya only as an ancient people, because it's more like a people that has, or a culture that has really been transformed. And it's not anymore like it used to be, but it's still there, the same people are still there. Mm-hmm. And in that area, there is a huge number of different sites of what used to be temple sites or cities. About 2,000 years ago, they started to come up like mushrooms, literally speaking, in this particular part of the world. And then the so-called classical Mayan culture, which is usually what we think of as the most advanced in terms of their thinking, in terms of their calendar and so forth. That lasted about until AD 800, when relatively suddenly it seems to have been abandoned, the different sites they had. And so it's about 1,000 years of history than that we derive these particular calendars that we are talking about. And then this calendar went out of use, and it's really only surfaced to the world since 1987, I think, when José Argüelles put the light on this with his event called the Harmonic Convergence. And even though scholars knew about this much before, it still was that particular event, I think, that brought it to the world, and suddenly something that has completely been out of most people's minds were reintegrated, you might say. And since then, there's been a tremendous focus on the so-called end date of the Mayan calendar. And most people place it December 21, 2012. Personally, I think it happened already about a year ago. But that is, in a sense, a detail, because we are talking about a calendar that has described about 16 billion years of evolution. In other words, it is a calendar system that describes the cosmos as it has evolved from its very birth, from what scientists today refer to as the Big Bang that happened when the Mayan calendar started. And so much of the interest has been, or the focus has been on a particular date. And where I'm coming from, that is not necessarily quite fair, because the Mayan calendar system is a system for understanding the world and who we are, which is much, 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 much more than just a date. And yet, you know, we are living at this particular time in a very significant shift of the universe. You might say that up until last year, it's all about sort of creating the universe. It's a divine plan that brings into existence the planets, the galaxies, the human beings, all the animals, and everything. And then you might say it pushes the human beings into developing their minds in such a way that they create civilizations and so forth, and now here we are. And this whole process is now being completed. And this is a huge shift, and it's not a shift that is happening on a particular date. But, of course, we can use a particular date to specifically look upon this shift, and we can also use it very... we can use it to sort of set new intentions or and so forth. Any date would work, but this is the one that has been chosen for that. And so this is the general background, I think. Then I shall be a little bit more specific and talk a little bit about the kind of pyramids that were built in these sites among the Maya.
Because, could you tell us where these pyramids actually come from? Did the Mayan people themselves, is it believed or understood that the Mayans built them, or is it the Mayan people who have found them and been interpreting them? And did they just appear and have become studied by the Mayan people, or?
These are pyramids that have been dated by the Mayans themselves. They always put a date on when they created the pyramids. So I really see no reason to doubt that this was these are pyramids that the Maya themselves had built. It's a little bit of a different situation compared to the famous Egyptian pyramids, because the Mayan pyramids, they are not that huge. They are maybe 30, 40 meters high or something like that. And it's not you don't wonder necessarily how they possibly were built, because they are more on a more human scale, so to speak. But they are built in certain ways. They are quite miraculously built. And the most famous of the pyramids, for instance, is the one in Chichen Itza, the pyramid of the plumed serpent. And that is built in a very interesting way, because it's built in such a way that on 2 days of the year, the spring and the autumn equinox, you can actually see like a light show being projected by the terraces that this pyramid is built in. It is built in 9 terraces, and on those particular dates, it produces an effect of light projected onto one of the staircases of the pyramid, which ends up on the ground in a serpent head, because this is the pyramid of the plumed serpent, and it's an amazing formation of 7 triangles of light, alternating with 6 triangles of darkness, that then forms like the scales on the back of a serpent, and this is sort of a quite fantastic thing when you see it. I've seen it a couple of times. It's a big event. Maybe 100,000 people come to Chichen Itza at this particular time, and then for about 20 minutes or so in the afternoon there, you see this being projected. And it is really fascinating, because, you're fascinated not because this is an enormous pyramid, but how were they actually able to build a pyramid that produced this particular effect only on one specific day? This is a very strange thing, really, and that's what really grips you. That's really what creates such a strong impression on you, is that they must have known from the very beginning. There's no way you can change a pyramid like this when you start building it. Mm. You have to know somehow from the very beginning, and somehow they did that. And so, in one sense, then this pyramid, which is the most famous, the most visited, I think 3 million people come there every year, the most visited of all the Mayan pyramids, and it's not spectacular in the sense of its size, but it's spectacular when you realize that this is why it was built and how it was built. And this is also, it's built in that way also because it really conveys the essence of the Mayan calendar system, which is, it was built in 9 levels, and which is the 9 terraces, the 9 that the pyramid was built in. But then these 9 levels project onto this staircase 7 triangles of light and 6 periods or triangles of darkness in between those. And that is exactly what the Mayan calendar is about, because you can say it is wave movements of 7 days and 6 nights. And this is something, of course, we've heard from the Bible and also from other religions, that God, in those views, created the world in 7 days and 6 nights. And the same theme comes back in the...
Okay, we're going to find Carl. We're not sure what happened, and we're going to go get him right away. God bless him. He's giving us a lot of really useful information that is very grounded and very useful for basic understanding of what the Mayan calendar is in its form. And he was just describing how one of these temples is made in a way that during the equinoxes, the light creates shadow and dances in the shape of a serpent that lasts about 20 minutes, and people come from all around to marvel at this phenomena of the serpent that... Okay, Carl is back. Great, welcome back, Carl.
Oh, I don't know when did I don't. Now it's hard for me to. Did I start to talk about the 7 days and 6 nights?
Yes, you were talking about the 7 days and the 6 nights and the relation and the different texts that we know of creation, and then we lost you.
Oh, okay. Well, so what I was saying there is that this theme then of 7 and 6. Which is the sort of heart of the Mayan calendar system. It's not exclusive to them. We find these ideas in many different ancient spiritual traditions, and we find them in major religions like Christianity and Judaism. But there is a difference because to the Maya, these days and nights of creation, they are longer time periods. They're not just singular dates, and some of these time periods are like a billion years old, and now up at the 9th wave, which is the one that has the highest frequency of change, these days and nights are as short as 18 regular dates, and so this is what the Mayan calendar then actually is all about. It is to specify what the first day and the second day and so forth, which when you study the Mayan calendar system, actually then becomes a way of understanding how the divine has created our world and has driven forward the evolution of the biological species as well as the evolution of the human mind. And this then occurs on 9 levels, which each has their own specific characteristics and bring specific phenomena into existence. And And as we climb to higher levels of the pyramid, to use that metaphor, there's this sort of frequency increase, so that the waves have had a 20 times increased frequency every time you climb a step. And now we are, as you mentioned, since about a year ago, we are in the ninth wave, and that is what is transforming the world, I would say.
I also noticed that there's a similarity in the serpent in the Kundalini conversation, the serpent being the energy that winds up, and people talk about Kundalini experience going up their spine and then having an ecstasy when it reaches the full spine. And might that be another analogy or way to view these waves that move from the lower levels and then encompass the next level and encompass the next level in a wave, like the serpent would move until it reaches its full ecstatic, its full activation of all of the, they use the word chakras when they talk about the Kundalini, the serpent energy moving through all the chakras and then activating all of them at once, which might be a fair analogy as well. Because is it true that in the understanding of how the Mayan calendar, the messages that it communicates, it's each wave builds on the next. It's not like one level started and then it completes, and then the next level starts and then it completes. It's actually the wave being the building, the enhancement, the gradation to the next level, incorporating all of the lower experiences. Is that correct?
Yes, it's absolutely correct. You know, I try to illustrate this what you're saying here with the sort of a metaphor, you might say, from popular music. In other words, that is from AC/DC, this rock band. They once made a song called "Let There Be Rock," and so then they say, let there be drums, and so then you only hear like the bass drums in the background, so to speak, and then it's let there be bass, and then on top of the bass on the drums you start hearing a bass riff coming in, and then there's a guitar, somebody says, and then the guitar starts to play the chords on top of the others, and then the song comes in on top of all of that. And that is sort of, that's what you're saying, and that is how the Mayan calendar works. In other words, just because the song comes in, that doesn't mean that the instrument part or the percussion part stops. Mm. No, they stay there always as the background. But what happens when you listen to that kind of a musical piece is that you start paying attention when the song comes in, which is the highest frequency of the different instruments. Then you start paying attention to the song, because you feel that's where the action is, that is where the main change is, and so forth. And that's exactly the same with the Mayan calendar. It's like, yes, all of these waves providing a certain rhythm, they're still there, they're still operating and going. But right now, what is of interest to us is mainly the highest waves, and especially, I would say, the ninth wave.
And what is the characteristics of the ninth wave? Share with us the significance. I'm very interested in learning more from your words of the ninth wave being the accumulation of the nine gods and the presence, the arrival of the nine gods, and how this energy, what is the sound in this? How is this now enhancing the music that's already been playing, so to speak?
Yeah. Well, the different waves, if we limit ourselves to maybe the four highest waves, which are the ones that are changing the human mind.
Okay.
Those waves are, they all have some kind of a filter. at least not the ninth wave, but the sixth wave, the seventh wave, the eighth wave, they each have some kind of a filter to the human mind. And this was referred to in the Bible as the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and the polarity between light and darkness. You can see it, you know, the Chinese symbol of yin yang is a very famous symbol of this. You can also see it in some of the listeners might have seen the Maya symbol called Hunapku, which is a Native American symbol for the same thing, the polarity between light and darkness. And in the biblical tradition, this is the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And basically, when human beings ate from that tree, the whole process of civilization began, and we were cast out, you might say, from the sort of previous unity consciousness of the Garden of Eden. What has happened then is that this polarity of the mind that is described, for instance, in the yin yang symbol, it creates a polarity, a dualistic way of relating to the world, of relating to other people, of relating to the spirit, of relating to the nature. All of those are, you might say, dualistic. They're not wholehearted, you might say. The Hopi, they usually, they have a metaphor where they talk about people as having been two-hearted rather than one-hearted. That's just been the way things are. This polarity of the mind has existed on a metaphysical level, but to say that it's metaphysical doesn't mean that it's not real. It's been very real, even though we have not been able to measure it or see it directly. It's actually so much a part of our own minds that we can't see it ourselves. We are really seeing the world through this polarized mind. And what is happening now, especially, is that when we come to the ninth wave, we're entering a mind without polarity. And this is a first. It hasn't been like that for ever since civilization first dawned on our planet 5,000 years ago. There has not been a mind without a polarity. And now this ninth wave is coming in and opening up the possibility for us to, again, you might say, come back to the unity consciousness that, metaphorically speaking, existed in the Garden of Eden. I don't mean to say that Garden of Eden was a real place or that the details of the biblical creation story are completely correct or anything like that, but as a metaphor of a unity consciousness and the fact that humans were thrown out at one point from the kind of unity with nature and God that they had experienced, that is still a useful metaphor, a useful image for what happened. But now, on top of all the civilizational development that has happened for the past 5,000 years, now we have the chance to connect to this ninth wave mind and transform ourselves. And to some people, I believe it will just happen automatically for whatever reasons that we will may never ever understand, and to other people, we may sort of seek to actually consciously connect to this mind without any filters, and go in a new direction. And my basic idea, my basic premise for understanding the world is really that we are creating the world outside as it is inside, which is sort of the other way around, I think, than the more official ways of looking at the world. In other words, what that means is that now that the ninth wave is changing us so that we are increasingly going into unity consciousness, we will at the same time increasingly start to create a world outside of ourselves that is consistent with that unity consciousness. It won't happen overnight. I think we're talking about a generation, maybe 20, 30 years or something on that scale. But the process has began. And a lot of people are looking upon this as a specially auspicious time because we are becoming aware that this is happening now. And that's the real importance of this particular time. It is not, I believe, to expect that now everything would suddenly just sort of fall in place in the best possible way, but it's the emerging understanding that ultimately we are divinely created beings, and what we have inside, we have the chance to project in the outside, and in this transformation of the human mind, we have the opportunity to create something better outside of ourselves as well.
I think that's a really good way of saying it, in the sense that when we were thrown out, or just using that is very effective for a lot of reasons. We're still in a very dominant culture that is imprinted by these cultural norms, regardless of religion. It's really way beyond religion. Yeah. And these things are permeating they've been permeated in our consciousness. And perhaps part of the duality introduction was to separate ourselves from our inner being. And the idea that we are an inside reality, period. It's an interesting thing to observe the challenge that some people have of going inside themselves and being with that person inside, and the recreation of unity inside the self is a really great challenge of our time for all of us, you know. And I wonder, how can you share with us, or what would you say were hallmarks of a duality? When you said it's metaphysical and it's real, and it has manifested itself in certain ways, I would suggest things like war and the ability to separate, to disassociate ourselves from killing another person would be an example of a dualistic mindset. And perhaps, you know, we're moving toward like our economic situation and the economic system being set up in a dualistic mindset, meaning some people have and some people don't. And so it can be very subtle. It can also be very blunt. And so do you have, what do you think in our evolution toward unity consciousness, is there a dying process that's reasonable to expect that is also perhaps spoken of in the Mayan calendar? Does it speak of in the transitional process about how one consciousness ends and continues? Because one of the things about the consciousness that we are also moving from is this idea that death is final and that it's the end point. And I wonder, in the Mayan calendar, as it is a calendar of evolution, as a calendar of transformation that is a reflection of life and life cycle, is there any clues about how we recognize and embrace the dying of an old cycle while we're integrating a new cycle?
I wouldn't really say so. And I should also say that you know, when it comes to the ancient Mayan civilization, it's very, very, we actually have very, very few inscriptions about our own time. And and then, as I said, the calendar, it was abandoned 1,000 years ago, and it was only recently then taken up again into the collective consciousness of humanity, you might say. And now, what is actually some people, including myself, who've gone very deeply into these matters, we're actually having to recreate what it meant, and doing this on a new basis, I would say, because today we're not just Mayans, but we have the whole knowledge from all the religions, all the cultures of the world, and it's only through an integration of all of these that we may come to a new understanding. But I do, you know, I want to maybe be a little bit more, again, specific about what it meant, how the world changed then 5,000 years ago. Because what happened is that, you know, a polarity, like a yin-yang symbol, you can imagine that your own faith is covered by the yin-yang symbol, making one half of it having a dark filter, and then the other half of it having no filter. In fact, what happened in that time was that it was the left brain half, which is the more analytical, the more logical brain half, that had no filter and had a chance to completely express itself. And the whole civilization then was created in such a way that it sort of favored all the aspects of reality that was left brain half. Whereas on the other hand, then the right brain half, which is the more intuitive, holistic brain half, you might say, that was covered by darkness. And so whatever happened here is that when this filter came, the worship of the goddess that had existed in so many cultures previously, it just disappeared, because it wasn't consistent with how people then started to see the world. And this polarized way of looking at things certainly created also wars, as you said, and violence, because it created this whole idea that some, you know, you would start to see people, some people you would see through the light, and some people you would see through the dark filter. And then people would project this outwards in such a way that they would say, oh, this is my people, the ones you saw through the light, and they're the good ones, so to speak. And then you would say that the others that you might see through the dark filter, they might be some other people, and you would say these are the bad ones. And then from this whole judgmental attitudes where you classify people and divide them, separate them in your mind, then came warfare, and also the idea that maybe you can kill those that you see in the dark filter, and so forth. And so it's so much, when you start to study the Mayan calendar, that you realize that everything works according to as inside, so outside. And then these filters are really what determines how we relate to the external world. Now, somebody might then ask, well, that sounds really bad. Why did the divine create it that way? Well, you know, yes, you might, there are all these consequences that I just mentioned of that kind of polarity. On the other hand, you might say that 5,000 years of left brain culture has created a world where we live in, most of us, or many of us at least, live in warm houses and have warm showers, and we, you know, the whole civilization essentially has been built on the emphasis on the left brain half. And at this point, I think we come to a point in our evolution where still very few people would just want to throw out everything like that. So you might say that the left brain focus that has existed for 5,000 years is taking us out from the existence of the caveman to people that have, you know, many people at least in the world have a material level that makes life not too bad. So there is a good side to this, and you start to see that there's a plan behind everything, and nonetheless, you know, we have now come to a point where we should not go further into that kind of polarized mind, I would say. Instead, we are meant to transcend it at this point and not have that as our only goal in life, to sort of find material betterment, but rather the in the future, with the ninth wave, the joy will be found much more through the wholeness. The joy will be found in through the connection to spirit, you might say, creating your own individual divine as a relationship, and what will happen with our civilization in the material sense, I think, is that, you know, essentially it will, much of it will stay, but, you know, as we go into this holistic way of looking, or a whole way of looking, we will start to, many of its aspects will sort of be phased out. And some of it may happen dramatically, but not necessarily. At this point, I don't think anyone knows exactly if there are any sort of sudden catastrophes coming. I see no reason to believe that, but what we do see, the reason to believe in is really that there is a shift now where we will phase out those aspects of our civilization that are based on this duality, and they're not consistent with the future anymore.
Mm. I like the word integration. I think that really is appropriate. And I also wonder how you address, in the light of the mind calendar, the understanding or the integration of the possible reality of the human race itself being manipulated to enhance the polarization toward the end of war, toward the end of a destructive experiment, because I'm with you in that it all has a positive or benevolent plan. There's nothing that goes through the universe that is not benevolent in its ultimate goal. So there's a reason, a rhyme, a pattern to be explored, developed, discovered in all of these many generations of struggle and strife and things that we've come to be conditioned to believe are what humanity is and what it represents, and that it isn't a bad place to be. It's just a place to keep moving from. It's just the stepping to the next level, which is what we're talking about. This is the opportunity to grow from where we've been and look at that. Well, gee, that was interesting. We were killing each other for 5,000 years, and how did that work? And, you know, now let's see what else we can do. And in the healing of unity, as I'm listening to you and really feeling the unity also really being the reunification with nature and in our material prowess and our material focus in whatever, however it's been the course of humanity to negate, deny the role of nature. We build houses with trees, and then we ignore the tree as a life, as a being itself. And so the reintegration of our understanding that the tree outside is actually a person of sorts, it's actually got a life and supporting life, and that matters as much as this awesome shelter from the rain right now, you know?
Yeah.
And how many places we can go in this idea that in our petroleum, the way that we derive energy from the degradation of the planet and the resources, the craze right now, the idea that we can just frack our way and dig out more coal and suck out more petroleum, and is, you know, that really in harmony with unity, in harmony with the way of being at a place of respect and acknowledgement of all life, you know. And that also ties into some of the economic structuring that we view, because energy, they call it energy, this whole way is a foundation of our material comfort, right?
That's how we look upon it, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, I'm not somebody who favors the belief that everything will happen in overnight, changes and so forth. But we have now, I think, with this shift in perception of how reality works, we have the chance, and some of us should really start to practice this to lead the way, you might say, and start to ask. You know, you mentioned here something I think very important about the trees. And to give you an example, what I mean is that today, and I think you said so, they will go out in the woods and, you know, just with these wood processing units, I think they call it, they would just cut down anything in the way, and then they will chop up the tree sometimes and make some kind of a tree mass that they will make furniture from, or any kind of other kind of wood product. And that's sort of when you're not even attempting to do it right. You just don't look at the trees as living beings, and you just indiscriminately cut them down. But I visited in Germany, in southern Germany, I think it was 2 years ago or something like that, a company called My Cocoon, who developed, you know, especially beds and massage benches, and they showed, and the Germans are very leading in this regard, I must say. They showed a completely different way of doing things. So they had this, you know, they had the idea. They went out into the woods. And then they found specific trees, and they would ask the trees if they, you know, if they were allowed to cut them down or not. And so they would cut down certain trees, and then when they, for instance, made the massage benches, it wasn't like just sort of cutting up the trees like nothing. No, they made sure that when they made a bed, that the part of the trees that was, you know, they would take all the long planks, and they would make sure then that where you had your head was also in the direction of the trees going up to the crown of the tree. Mm. And so everything that they did was sort of in, they used the trees, but it was always done with the respect to the tree and what the tree had come there for, and also then, again, to to recreate the kind of harmony that's in there, that so that the person who would sleep in that bed, her head would always be facing in the direction of the leaves and the crown of the tree. And this whole way of relating to nature, it just shows how some people are leading the way by making these kind of changes, by shifting their entire way of relating to nature, or relating to the trees. And I should ask, you would think they're not just sort of cutting down, producing the trees, or cutting down at a maximum rate. But it turns out that this company is immensely successful. I don't know how long an order demand they have. For instance, massage therapists, they want to have these kind of benches that are made exactly in as much as we can through alignments with the original design of nature, you might say. Mm-hmm. And this way of thinking that they have demonstrated in practice through their company, these are things we can do in whatever we do, and not just sort of have that kind of attitude of with nature, that it's something that we can sort of just indiscriminately cut down, or whatever we do. It's the same with animals that we eat, or anything like that. We may not necessarily, I'm not a vegetarian myself, and we may not necessarily be able to stop eating meat or anything like that. But we can, at least, we can start to ask the questions, to see and start to see things differently in such a way that we treat all aspects of nature with respect and not indiscriminately, and think about what we're doing and shift this way of sort of looking at nature just through a dark filter that we've been doing for 5,000 years. And this is possible for everyone. And I'm also confident that people will find joy in exploring these kind of things, and that it may also become a successful way of living in a way that you might not necessarily think of, because so that we are taking out of our way, this sort of just looking at dollar signs and operating completely from that very abstract and lifeless background, and to start coming from relating to nature in a way that shows that we value it as beings, whether it's trees or animals or anything like that, and this, I think, it's really part of the transformation that is going on today.
Mm-hmm. The value system itself being radically altered from the monetary system, which has dominated our consciousness in defining value and reorganizing and organizing our values of time and each other. The value system, as we have been living with the debtor economy, has really taught us to commodify not only every tree, but each other. And the way we look at each other as, an object of, serving our personal agendas or useless. There's no nuance. There's no room for process or subtle or beauty or anything other than if we have any need, as determined by our very, very narrow filter in our current very narrow understanding of what we think we're needing to do. It's a really interesting thing this debtor economy has done to our value system. And it's really allowed this duality consciousness to sink in and root in very profound ways that does, I really feel that it's going to require a very personal commitment on each person.
Yes, and it's personal. And it's, you know, it's not really that the economic system does anything to us, because that is, again, sort of giving, putting the responsibility out there. It's more how we choose to relate to others. It's our opportunity to change our relationship to living, and by so doing, we will also sort of downplay this economy, which so much sort of at this time highlights monetary gain. But the economy is ultimately, not only ultimately, is very directly a product of our own way of relating to reality. And I want to emphasize that. It's all passing right from so outside.
Absolutely. The debtor economy is rooted in victim.
Yeah.
It's very much the reflection of what you're stating, in that it's the reflection of victim. It's saying that because I don't have money, I can't make my dreams come true. It's saying, and all too often, the controllers of the monetary system have been effective in determining on some level. And I agree with you. It is a personal choice, ultimately. And this is what our collective project may be at this point as we evolve into unity consciousness and as we evolve into valuing the every single life, that one person on the street is one too many, you know. And that one person who's hungry is just not tolerable. We live on a planet that has more than enough food for everybody. And as we as a collective grow in that empathy and that love and that respect for all life, that is, I really feel, the ultimate shift that is the end game here, if you will. And how are we change agents in that, and how are we consciously addressing that and working both worlds? You know, we all have that sort of cleaning up to do or reorganizing and ourselves, and we also have the interface that we have in the world itself that is shifting, and we're part of the shift, and we're getting there. And where do we go when we are in a community of people where the bottom drops out? What else do we have, you know, but our inner peace, you know?
And how do you see
where the unity consciousness is at, in how have you seen the unity consciousness expressing itself? Can you give us some examples of some specific things that you've noticed in our world, how it's reflecting back at us already?
Well, you know, I think I already gave a little bit of an example when I mentioned this company in Germany.
Right. That's really important.
It is, because, and I do see also, staying with that, I do see companies now that, you know, it's where it's not just about, these are usually small companies, but where it's not just, that's not the only thing. It's about money making. That, of course, they want to make a living, so to speak. But there are companies out there today that are that has a commitment to serve or want to serve, and they won't compromise that just because of the monetary considerations. And that is something I think I've encountered increasingly in the recent time. Now, Other than that, I mean, I don't. It's certainly not something you read about in the paper, the kind of changes that is happening in the world, because the papers are still very much sort of emphasizing the negative things in the world, and that's how the media are operating very much.
So as individuals, what we can do is become much more conscious of our choices in the companies that we are supporting, and we can become much more aware of how we want to be in our everyday lives and the energies that we want to support in our personal relations, and how are we ourselves inspired to become more empathetic, more aware, more conscious, more enhancing potential, even if it's only a potential we feel at this point. It's just this idea. Some people will only think, oh gosh, you know, that might be crazy, but it starts with an idea. So even if all you can think of is this idea, then that is also a place to start. You can just begin with, okay, if this is a world of unity consciousness, what does that look like in me? And how can I live that? How can I today make a little step toward unity? For example, perhaps even something as simple as opening the door or going to help an elderly neighbor, or, you know, going out with a friend that you know is going through a kind of a hard time, you know? Yes. These are all expressions of joining the family.
And I think, you know, it would take some time for people to, with this new ninth wave coming in, it would still take some time for people to rise about the cynicism that we have become used to, sort of. Sometimes the way forward, I mean, we'll have to make it stepwise, but I think it has to be, you know, it's clear that everyone can take that step, these kind of steps, and for this, it is also important, I would say, to study seriously the Mayan calendar, because if you do, then you will realize that this is not just sort of some kind of a crazy fantasy or something like that. You know, it's really a very thoroughly researched thing that tells us that this is the way that the world is now going. And we have reasons, we have strong reasons to actually go into that and not, I mean, because we will be hurt once or twice or whatever whenever we take these kind of steps. But nonetheless, the gate is now opened already, I would say. The gate is opened. And that is the way that the direction things will be going, and so what I'm also saying is that when the Mayan calendar is seriously researched, you do come to realize that this is just the way things are, and the world will change, and it will change in a way that allows for more joy and more belonging, more connection, and so forth. So I might add here, it's maybe a little bit what you would expect, but it's also, it is kind of sad that there's been so many sort of really silly, crazy, you know, the whole idea the world is coming to an end, wherever that came from. It has nothing to do with the Mayan calendar. It's just sort of some kind of a crazy mindset that has generated these kind of things. But I guess people have just become used to that kind of cynicism, and that's the reason people, rather than actually studying what it's all has been about, they have sort of gone some of them have got been caught up in whatever crazy ideas like the movie 2012 or stuff like that are out there. And, you know, maybe I don't need to say it, but I still am going to say it here, namely that there's nothing in the Mayan calendar about an end of the world or anything like that. That's things that are completely made up by modern people.
Mm. Yeah, the end of the world is kind of a funny idea in the conversation of life itself, because there's always a new beginning when there's always a cyclic reality happening. You know, one thing, a phase will end, a new one begins, and the phase will end, a new one begins. So it's almost like an addiction watching people. Yeah. Who really they're addicted, I guess, to duality consciousness in a way, and that need for the fight. People love the fight. They want to be right no matter what. Being right is it, and that's the end game for them. And, you know, okay, that's where they're at. That's what they need to be, but that isn't sustaining, and that isn't something that you or I decided. That's something that the planet cannot sustain for obvious reasons. You know, it's becoming so basic that this whole course has completed itself. You know, we just simply cannot go on in a dualistic mindset, in a mindset that values itself as a material only being that is only driven by external reward or external prizes, in the sense of this idea that you are your car. You know, I think America is an interesting conversation in that, because it is one of the most, it is the most material driven, the most material identified country. Okay. It's also the youngest country. And it's also sitting in a very important place, I think, in the evolution of consciousness on this level of the world, in that it's holding a seed of what has been called freedom, you know? Mm-hmm. So how the American consciousness, how the American collective is going to get its feet in the water with a self-reflection motivation, the integration of the Eastern, if you will, the idea that your inner being is of great value, as well as what kind of car you have in the driveway. It's a very interesting time to watch how this transformation is going to evolve. I'm very interested in that.
Yeah, I think people will have to experience themselves this inner transformation, and meaning that I think that there is people would have to sort of find to some extent choose the tools to transform themselves spiritually, and it will only be lasting if those tools are such that they give joy to people, causeless joy. That's an important point I want to make here. Hello? Are you there?
Yeah, I lost your sound for a second, and I was wondering if I was lost altogether.
Yeah. So I think the point in a society like the American, which you're mentioning here, people will, I said that people would have to find the tools to find a spiritual transformation. But then I also said, now that can be take very many forms, and I think it will only successfully change this whole materialistic mindset if you can find those tools that truly brings an inner joy to people. In other words, that they experience causeless joy, joy without any cause,
mm-hmm.
Then you will see another value. And I find that. I have had those experiences, and it's very important, I think, to have that. Because otherwise, the change in relationship to the material reality and all those things will sort of be, I don't know, either it will not come naturally unless you're actually able, through your spiritual path, to find a joy without reason, a causeless joy. And that is possible. I know that from experience, and I recommend everyone to seek such a path. But, and only as that happens do I believe that people will start to downplay whatever materialistic ambitions they might have had.
I agree. I like the way you put that, causeless joy, just simply the joy of breathing. just having yeah. this day is ecstatic, and whatever we're going to do with it is ecstatic, and that's enough. That's enough.
Yeah. Yes.
That's the gift of life right there. That's all there is, and you don't need anything else but to be with that right there.
Yeah.
And this is... The materialism, the material-based identity, and the idea that the human is just a body, this is also part of the Mayan calendar consciousness as well, is it not? The understanding that the humans gain of themselves as spiritual beings. How is that interwoven in these levels of mind that began with the sixth wave? How is it that the human evolves from this understanding that it's just a body to that it's divine being in the cosmos? How does that express itself in the Mayan calendar?
Yeah, well, I have written a couple of books, and you mentioned them initially. One of them, The Purposeful Universe, actually describes how our bodies were created. And then there, I have another book or several other books that talk about the evolution of the mind, like the transformation, Mayan calendar and transformation of consciousness. And these are somewhat different things. Because our emotions and our feelings are very much connected to our bodies, which are like the lowest levels of the pyramid of creation, the ninth level pyramid. And then what comes on top of that is that the mind that was created by the sixth wave and then continue with the seventh wave and the eighth wave. And... those mind developing has tended to also have a transforming in a way almost like a negative effect on our emotional life, because also our emotions have very much been colored by these filters that I mentioned that sort of limit our experiences and color our emotional experiences and how we relate to our bodies. And so what I think is happening now, when these filters are coming back, disappearing, and the mind is actually starting to lose the dominating roles it has had previously in everything we do, is that it opens up for us to connect to our to experience our emotions in a more natural way, to experience emotions that are not just filtered through this particular mind and it's the dualistic mind and that's why I'm talking about this return of the causeless joy, because once the mind gets out of the way, then you will, and everything is in unity then you will be able to experience your emotions quite fully in another way. And from that will come this experience I mentioned of a causeless joy. So one way of expressing what is happening in the world today is that the mind is losing its dominance. This is sort of mind-blowing, as they would say. It is really mind-blowing because, you know, we've had, for instance, you might say the world has for about 250 years had a tremendous development of the industrial world, everything that has to do with the material reality. And that has all come out of that mind that was created by the sixth wave and so forth. And so many people, they expect this material world, it will just continue forward and things will be more and more technologically advanced and so forth. But really, that's probably not what is going to happen, because as the mind is becoming less dominant, we will the continuation of that kind of speeded up technological development will not go on forever, and it's actually, I think it will slow down as people come to more and more enjoy their true feelings, their true emotions, and their true spiritual relationship to nature and those around themselves. So it's a big part of what's happening is the you might say the deactivation of the global mind, the decoupling of our minds, and this is what will allow our bodies to thrive. And but maybe most importantly, it will allow us to truly enjoy our own feelings, our own emotions, without emotions that are, you might say, twisted or suppressed or changed by the mind that has dominated the world for 5,000 years.
That's interesting. I had a direct experience of that. In September of 2011, when I was in New York City, when the intentional demolition of the World Trade Centers happened, and it was very interesting to me to observe how immediately following the event, how many people were openly expressing their need to make changes in their lives and turn away from their very focused, goal-oriented, career, money-based reality. That there was a huge exodus of people from that consciousness at that time that... Yeah. By the dislodging of these feelings, or just being brought to this state of feeling of the event of what their own lives felt like, they in that moment chose a new path, and I'm sure they kept going. You know, it was very strong, and that was a direct example of what you just said, that the technological advancement has not been in alignment with the holistic goal and harmony with nature, with unity consciousness. So in a way, what you're saying makes perfect sense. How could it continue at that pace? It hasn't matured with the heart, if you will.
No.
So the correction of the universe itself is now going to be the dominant theme, rather than the manipulation of the mind in the correction deciding position, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's another thing that I've noticed coming into our world that is an example of unity consciousness in our community, and that is something that is openly called the share economy. And more people pulling their resources together and finding new ways, new innovative ways to connect in businesses and connect in their home resources, sharing cars, sharing rooms, sharing food, making time for neighbors. There's organizations more and more growing all the time that are addressing the economy as the share economy, how we can work together to pool our resources to make the earth work. And it's even into the highest realms. There are people who are actually lobbying and making really brilliant presentations to the UN to introduce share economy as a public policy. Now, these are all very special things that I'm very excited about and are things that we can work on. I'm excited to be part of working on that because this, as we pull out of this drudgery of sorts of this, the duality consciousness, it seems that connection is the thing that brings us all back together, ultimately, you know, to connect with each other, to connect somehow in the world, that it's not ending at all, that it's actually just beginning. We're actually having a new experience.
Yeah. A certain kind of world is ending, I would say, but the world is not ending.
Hmm. And what are some of the things in the world consciousness in that would be very much in, I lost my thought. Okay, sorry, I'll come back. We are looking at the close of one way of being, at the close of one world consciousness and the opening of a new world emerging and a new world consciousness. And in this transition, it is a challenging time and it's also an exciting time. And as people who can be aware of what's going on, that gives us an opportunity to be agents of that change somehow and help folks along that are wherever they're at in that. And would you share with us, I've noticed in your work as well, you've been an advocate of meditation and of gathering. And will you share with us some of your ideas about what an appropriate meditation would be at this time? And how people might be able to focus their mind and truly enter into the discipline. And I am also, I think that it's really important to really study the Mayan calendar. If that's your spiritual tool, study something, take something on and really take it on and really understand the history and how that relates to you and what your story is. The studying and learning history is so important to putting things in perspective. And then in the now, what are appropriate meditations that you would recommend for people who are ready to move on that level?
Yeah, well, my own source of spiritual inspiration at this point it primarily comes from the so-called Oneness University in India, and I wrote about this in my book the Mayan Calendar and Transformation of Consciousness, that is, I wouldn't call that traditional meditation. It is, for instance, something called a oneness blessing or a diksha, which is it's a kind of a blessing that to some extent decouples your mind or takes the power out of your mind. And that is for me at this point, and I think it will continue on that path. That is a practice, and I know it's offered in many different American cities, which actually brings people in contact to spiritual joy, and also equivalent to, you might say, a spiritual awakening, which would be like a more permanent, more long-term way of taking out the power of the mind. So that is what I found for myself as the most, the most joy-bringing inner transformation. And it wouldn't be meditation, probably, in the old way of speaking about it. And my feeling is really that meditation is most forms of meditations. The way that we have been practicing it, and as you probably know, I've been initiating some fairly large-scale global meditations over the years. So, but I see, at this point, I'm actually see less value in these collective meditations. I think that I see much more this thing for the individual to find her or his spiritual joy, really to be at the most important in the transformation that you can find. More traditional forms of meditation may not necessarily have a place 30 or 40 years into the future. I've changed my mind, you might say, a little bit. I'm not now as much into this idea of collective meditations as I used to be, because really I think it is the individual who has to discover something in herself and from that find also to transform her relationships to the world.
And so from that very personally grounded spiritual understanding, one then understands what it is in the world to take on. And it feels to me that part of this transformation is to do that, is actually to engage in the world around us and to actively engage in our part in the universe. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on that, because it's definitely a time where I feel that the energy is saying all hands on deck. You know, you need to be paying attention to what's going on your planet now.
Well, yes, but frankly, I guess I'm doing it, personally at least, I'm doing it maybe less. It depends, of course, paying attention to what's happening on planet. It could be very many different things.
Right.
And because you sort of choose what you pay attention to. Mm-hmm. To me, it seems like we are now in the very beginning of a shift. And as I said, I thought if you want an exact date for this particular shift, it was last year, October 28th. But that's not, it's still so much in the early phases. And I hope that people as soon as possible sort of are making this inner transformation. And out of that will unify their efforts when a certain number of people have found this unity consciousness. And I don't think there are so many people that actually have like a stable unity consciousness in themselves. It certainly is not the majority of the inhabitants of the world. But I am also convinced that it will increase, and it is increasing, and that we take on changing the external world in the rhythm that we are becoming ready for it ourselves through our inner transformation. Yeah, of course, I'm not saying that there are not urgent tasks to take on, and I you know, I certainly hope people, you know, that there are many things that can be improved. But we are also, I believe, in a time when there might be premature ideas that are not really that for how to change the external world, if you understand what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
If we are to change the external world, then we might look at what really, you know, we might not be exactly ready for knowing exactly how to do this at this particular point. I have confidence that we will become ready for that. And, you know, there are, and as I also mentioned, I already talked about how we can take practically in our life, how we can take the small little steps, and we can change our companies, we can change our relationships to you mentioned the share economy and all these kind of things. And yes, absolutely, we should take these small little steps at this point. But I also think when it comes to how on a large scale we are to transform the world, maybe we're not yet quite ready to know what the solutions are, and there is the need for more of us to fully go into this unity consciousness permanently in order to really see what are the best solutions and not just the premature solutions to how the world is going to be organized.
That makes sense in that the universe does self-organize. Is that in a way what you're suggesting?
To
become part of the organizing process that's happening and then allow the universe to set itself right through us, which is the complete converse of what we've been doing in our attack the problem approach.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hmm. You know, that's such the tall order of the day. You put that so very well. And that it always comes back down to us being the change, no matter where we turn these days.
Right. That's what Gandhi said. Be the change you want to see in the world. And actually, there is no way, there is no other way.
And that is what the Mayan calendar talks about.
Yes, as inside, so outside. Do you know why? By the way, why Gandhi said, "Be the change you want to see in the world."
No.
Okay. Well, it's kind of a good story. The origin is that there was this lady who came to Gandhi with her little son, and a 5-year-old son, I think. And the lady said, you know, she thought that her son was eating too many cookies, too much into candy, and it wasn't good for him. Now, the son didn't listen to her, so she decided, okay, let's go to a man like Gandhi, who is respected and is a man and whatever, which would probably be a difference in India at the time. And so she goes to Gandhi with her son and says to Gandhi, you know, tell my son he should not eat candy. And Gandhi doesn't tell the son that. I don't know, can't remember exactly what he said, but he completely avoids to scold the son I don't know, brings into completely different matters. And so she goes away there, and then she's sort of upset with Gandhi because he doesn't. he doesn't, he didn't tell her son not to eat the candy. Then, then she, at some point, she comes back to Gandhi and alone and asks him, you know, why didn't you tell my son to stop eating candy? And then Gandhi says that because I'm eating all these little cookies, and so I cannot tell him not to eat cookies. Because you have to be the change you want to be in the world, or to be the one, be the change that you want to see in the world. And that's really, that's a true story. That's how it originated. It wasn't in the big things about peace or anything like that. No, it was just that. But it's still a very valuable device, a very valuable thing to say.
That's a great story. Yeah, well, challenge the hypocrite within before you start preaching.
Yeah.
Oh, that is a great story. Thank you for sharing that. I had never heard that.
No, and it shows his integrity, so to speak. I mean, he could have pretended I'm this big authority, you know, tell the right thing to say and all that kind of stuff. But no, he didn't do that.
Which is a great example for all of us right there, you know. Just be where you're at, and that's got to be good enough somehow, you know. At least you won't be fooling yourself.
Right. Yeah.
That's really fantastic. I am really grateful that you have taken time to be, you are sharing with us some really, really valuable information in this interview, some really sound guidance, some really sober counsel, and things that people, you know, we all can take to heart and really put our feet on the ground as, you know, we are continuing into our transformation, however it's going to evolve. And I really appreciate your words of confidence and your words of hope that, you know, that this is the process. You know, we're going to get there, and it's really okay however we're going to do it. It's just what we're going to do with it. But also the reminder that we do have a lot of power in how this manifests by the choices we make every day. And that's really helpful. In your experience with the Mayan calendar, if we could back up just a little, because we haven't, I sort of intentionally wanted to keep us in the now with this, but I wonder if we could back up just a little for the listeners and also for the respect of the calendar itself and the indigenous culture, the ancient culture, and the way that we have this opportunity to explore history in a new way. And I wonder if you would share with us a little bit in your journey with the Mayan people and the Mayan culture and the Mayan calendar, how the integration of the learning worked for you and how you developed your understanding of the calendar itself. The important piece being the heart-head integration. This is something that I've always appreciated about your approach. And I wonder if you could share with us a little bit about you that.
I can do that. Well, you know, to begin with, I'm not somebody who has learned very much directly from Mayan elders when it comes to the calendar. It all started, my experience is started in 1979, and which means that, you know, there are very few people. I'm not somebody jumping on the bandwagon, as you might say. I've really have been with this calendar in some sense for a very long time, and it really started when I was then 29 years old, and made a trip like a backpacker, you might say, down to Guatemala and southern Mexico, and I was sort of attracted to the pyramids. But that was a completely different thing in 1979, I must say. This is, you know, now Chichen Itza has become like a big theme park and everything like that, and it's all fenced in, and millions of people and tourists and so forth, and it's good that people are coming there, of course, but I was fortunate to come there when it was still somewhat of an archaeological site, and I would even sneak in at the site in the middle of the night and go into the, I don't know, I suppose I was not supposed to do that, but go into the Princess the Observatory at Chichen Itza in the middle of the night, and so be able to look through the different openings in that particular structure and see how the stars would come in and so forth. I remember I was there at night with a full moon or at least strong moonshine, and just by myself strolling into this amazing Mayan old site. And that got to be a strong experience to sort of that it's difficult to have today. Often today, even the pyramids are cut off and you can't really climb then and all that kind of thing. Because actually climbing a pyramid is something that every step has some kind of an information in physical form, and it goes into your body when you do this kind of climbs. But regardless, I was there, and at that time, I was, I was working, I was still in my scientific studies, becoming a doctor, I was basically working in Sweden in laboratories in a very different environment, you might say, compared to Mexico, which is Sweden is quite a, what shall I say, quite a rational country, and compared to Mexico, which is much more, much more colorful country. And so it was quite a change in environment. And I really felt very much at home in those sites and in the Mexico, and also very much took to heart the Mayan people that I would encounter. What made the strongest impression on me, I think, was, however, that sometimes they would come up to me, you know, and sometimes they don't speak Spanish, they just speak some native Maya language and something, but they still, it seemed, it happened a couple of times that they would come up to me and they would say that they would give me some little thing or some amulet or something like that and then disappear. And so I got those little experiences played a big role, because somehow it seemed they saw something in me that connected me to them or to that tradition. So when I came back from that particular trip, I felt very happy, because I felt that it's a purpose to my life, and that hasn't left me since. Then it's been a long time, and I left my scientific career in the early 90s, and then started to devote myself entirely to the Mayan calendar, and to research that and make it understandable as far as I could to ourselves, to modern people, and through this research which has gained some attention, then I've had contact with the more notable Mayan elders and so forth, but I'm still very much I'm coming still very much from, you might say, a rational mindset. I don't see it as my task to sort of say exactly what the contemporary Mayan elders are saying, because they can speak for themselves. I'm coming from another mission. I'm taking the ancient Mayan calendar system that I have researched thoroughly, and then I'm combining that with all the scientific knowledge of the modern world, and so that it becomes tangible for people like ourselves, and takes on a meaning. It's amazing, really, how when I think about it, that because when I was in Mexico in 1979, I first heard about the fact that their calendar was coming to an end, and I read a book that said it would come to an end in 2011, and now at that point, it was completely unknown knowledge, and then I started to spread the word about this myself. Arguelles was the one that first made it broadly known in America, but I started in other places, by the time I started to talk about that, nobody had heard about the Mayan calendar, the fact that it was coming to an end, that we would then say. And now it's something that the whole world knows about. So it's quite an amazing change that has happened. So somehow I was guided to go into something that was completely unimportant when I first encountered it, unimportant to the world. And now it's increasingly people are experiencing that. It is something important. And I should add here something, and a couple of things. One is that, you know, obviously it's just silly stuff to talk about the end of the world, but it's actually not quite true either to say that the calendar is ending. I mean, it actually continues, but that is a more complex matter. It's not as simple as it used to be, I should say, and I'm not going to explain why, but I should and what people primarily at this point need to know is really to that this is the time for us all to seek this the path to fully go into this unity consciousness. I'd like to say also I'm writing on a trilogy that I call the Paradigm Shift Trilogy. And the first of the books is ready, and it's starting, the publication process has started. I hope to get it out in half a year or so. And the trilogy will have three parts, obviously. And the first one is all about the rise of civilization 5,000 years ago. It will be called The Global Mind and the Rise of Civilization. The second one will be about altered states of consciousness and spirituality. And only the third one will be about the future of the Mayan calendar. And I don't know when the third volumes will be out. I think that would take us at least one more year to research. But when it comes to the first volume, it will be a very powerful book, I think, which presents a completely new way of understanding how civilizations arose on our planet. Mainly through divine inspiration. There was a shift that provided a new form of divine inspiration 5,000 years ago. And that is what our minds are coming out of, and that is also what all our civilizations have come out of. And I think it is at this point important to understand better what the mind is, because it is something we will have to relate to the mind in a new way in the time ahead. We've talked about it here now, that we'll have to become more, I'm not saying have to, but in the sense that we are invited by the cosmos to become more, go more into unity consciousness. And one of the most important things that will be blocking that is actually then the mind. And so it's important to learn what the mind is. I have done a quite original research around what the mind is that I hope will help people to not identify themselves with the mind, but actually see that the mind is something that can sometimes be used, and we have used it for creating our civilization, but it's also something that we don't always use, and we don't need it in all our relationships. And in order to find the way back to the joy, we what benefits us is probably to learn is to decouple from the mind, to not have it be as dominating as it has been until now.
That sounds fantastic, Carl. I'm very excited about that, and it's right on time. You know, we are so ready now for exactly what you're saying, for a whole new way to look at ourselves and look at our origins and look at what is the story. And, you know, we're ready for some new ideas to explore here. Yeah. And I'm curious in your exploration starting 5,000 years, you know, there is an older culture, correct? You know, do you think that there? How does that tie into your exploration?
No.
You don't think that? No.
No, I don't think so. Hmm. See, that's what people have been for 20 years or so, or maybe more. The if you like, in the New Age community or spiritual community or whatever. The dominant thought has been that people 5,000 years ago, the idea has been that there were people from Atlantis or people from extraterrestrials or whatever who sort of came down and created this civilization or made the people living there create. And what I'm saying now, and I think it would be a very, very compelling case, it's almost like a closed case, is that, no, that was not what happened. Once you realize that there was a sudden divine inspiration and realize the nature of that divine inspiration, you can start to realize that there is no need to believe that there was this kind of Atlantis or whatever lost civilization or whatever ideas people have had around that. No, the missing link is not an old civilization. The missing link is the global mind. It's the divine mind. That's what we will. I think we will in the future learn to accept.
Are you there?
Yes, I am. There was some sort of noise there. Yeah.
Okay, I wasn't sure where that was going from. That's interesting. That is really interesting, and I really look forward to checking that out. You know,
it will be interesting. I can promise you that.
I have no doubt. Well, we have. We're coming along to the end of the show as usual. It was a very packed and quite pleasant sharing in the last 2 hours. We have been visiting here with Dr. Carl Johan Kalemann. He is an intuitive Mayan scholar and trained scientist and very inspired person for our new age of unity emerging. And to learn more information about your upcoming projects, Carl, where should people go to find you? Do you recommend a website or a Facebook? Where are you at in the contact you social media place
now?
Right now?
Well, I have my own website, which is called kalleman.com, C-A-L-L-E-M-A-N.com.
Okay.
And people can, there my books are available, and there are also courses that I'm having at the International Metaphysical University that can be, that are available. And if people want to be on my list of newsletters, it's not really a newsletter. I only send out when I have things that I feel I want to say, and then they can email me. There's an email thing on my website there. So that's a way of getting in contact with me for any discussions or. Especially for that. So it's Kalleman, Kalleman.com.
Great. That is great. Thank you so much for joining us. Yeah, thank you. And I want to also just take a moment here to thank BBS Radio for their outstanding support back at the house for making this broadcast possible, and for all of our friends in high places, all of the ancestors, all that brought us to this point and have been joining us in spirit. Thank you, everybody, all of the listeners. Thank you so much to the listeners for joining us, who will listen in future and will be joining in the unity consciousness. And hopefully there'll be some jewel that can be of value for you here in these last 2 hours as we experience the transformation from one world to the new. That's such a nicer way to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So would you like to offer any final words, and then I'll sign us off?
Excuse me?
Would you like to offer any final words or message, and then I'll sign us off?
No, I think I've said my what I want to say, and which is that at this time we're in a very significant shift, and basically the creation of the universe is complete after 16 billion years, and nothing will happen. Don't expect anything to happen on a particular date. The only reason things would happen is that, you know, for whatever inner changes people are making on this date or any other date, and those inner changes, I hope, will inspire them also, us all, to take these little steps all the time, because we are now all together at a point of transforming reality that will be lasting for, you know, at least the 20-30 coming years. And I wish everyone to participate and take part in that transformation.
Yay. Thank you so much, Carl. And
thank you.
And this is, we've been speaking again with Carl Kalleman. You can find out more information about him at kalleman.com. That's Kalleman.com. This is the Alchemy of Light broadcast. I am Jamil Graham, your host, and you can learn more about me and keep abreast of the shows and such coming up at alchemyoflight.org. And so this will conclude our broadcast for this beautiful day in December in the Gregorian calendar and in our 13th lunation here in the world connecting with the Earth and her celestial company, approaching our solstice in just a few days. So please, in this awesome time coming and these great opportunities, please do take good care of yourselves and take good care of each other. Until next time. Bye-bye.